we talk about.
How many of y'all read The Harbinger?
I haven't read it. I just have watched him speak.
Yeah.
I'm going to read it.
Yeah.
You know,
there's there are prophets in the land, and many of them are speaking words, and we hear them or don't hear them. We're like if Jeremiah was in our midst, and most people wouldn't even know,
right,
which is the way it was.
Right.
He's somebody, and there's a guy named Joel Rosen something or another.
Rosenberg.
Yeah. There are people out there who are basically saying that we are a covenantal people and that God is dealing with us because we have abandoned our covenant. And he goes to great lengths to show our covenantal background, the little church in front of this and that, you know, all that kind of stuff. Those are all very interesting, and the general tenor of his message is certainly true. And whether or not all the little details that he brings to bear are exact or accurate, sort of unimportant. You know, like this church and that wall and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that's all very interesting.
Right.
And maybe it may exactly be true, but it's not the important part. Because if we make that the important part, somebody comes around and they dig up some sort of map that says this isn't true. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And then we dispense the message. So I think the message is clearly true.
Okay.
And it's not just him. I mean, there's hundreds of voices out there if we would listen to them. There are ministries in the church.
Yes.
Apostles, prophets, pastors, evangelists, and teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And gifts include being able to be prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
There are temperaments. There are mercy givers and prophetic people and whatever. So when we say somebody is prophetic, that doesn't necessarily make them a professional prophet. It just means that they tend to speak out of the prophetic word of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
You have to be a fairly mature Christian to be even able to handle the word prophet with people.
Well, yes. I mean, yes and no. Because remember, out of the mouths of babes,
right,
God speaks. So one of the things that we're told in the scriptures is that we never judge people by what they say, but by how they live. True and False Prophets is a book by Don Basham that I recommend to you if you're at all interested in the issues of who should you listen to and why. Because there are some people who have correct things to say, but their lifestyle's terrible. We know who the people of God are, not by their words or their deeds, but by their fruit. And so the book, True and False Prophets, outlines that real clearly,
okay,
I think.
What,
True and False Prophets?
True and False Prophets.
True and False Prophets by Don Basham.
B-A-S-H-A-M.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Don Basham was the founder of the Holy Spirit Teaching Mission in Leesburg, Florida in the 60s. And he was joined after a while by Bob Mumford and Charles Simpson and a number of other people, five or six other ministers, and they moved the Holy Spirit Teaching Mission to Fort Lauderdale, and from there they launched the discipleship movement that went out throughout all the 70s and 80s. Whatever. I've read his book. There are probably 1,000 other people out there I've never heard of that are saying the things of God. Rabbi Zechariah is one who's been around for a long time, who's been teaching us. Sometimes David Jeremiah has a lot to say. You know, it's just ask the Lord to show you who to listen to, and the why is more how they live and manifest the Lord in their life than what they have to say. You know, Tim LaHaye and his buddy are not people you want to listen to.
Jenkins.
So,
Jenkins.
Yeah.
Gary Jenkins.
Yeah, they're talking about an event that's biblical that's coming and whatever, but. And frankly, they will tell you they're writing fiction, but they don't say it real loud because there's a whole lot of people who are just anxious to listen to them as if they were being prophetic.
They don't know the difference. Yeah.
Do you want to mention that movie? Kelly, the other day, had sent me a text about there's a movie coming on TV, and it was called David. And it's been so much about what we've been reading.
Yeah, it was on TBN, which is not a station we usually watch.
Mm-hmm.
And even though David Jeremiah's got a program on there. I don't watch a lot of religious TV. Not that you shouldn't, I just don't. so much of what's on religious TV is about building ministries and raising money, and but that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean you can't that there isn't good things that are said there. So this was on TBN. It was called David, and there's, you know, we've all seen biblical movies, and sometimes they really trash them up, and sometimes they really, you know, do a nice job. This did a very nice job. It was culturally and historically accurate, as well as being biblically accurate. So some of what we're going to talk about tonight, you know, one thing people who have a real walk with the Lord are still human. And just because you have a real walk with the Lord doesn't mean you never make mistakes, you know, or you never say things in a salty way, or you never get angry or get upset, or, you know what I'm saying? And so some people look at the humanity of people and they go, you know, well, they can't be any good, you know. So that would be a mistake. I mean, that's what happened to Jesus. They looked at his humanity and said, he can't be the Messiah. He doesn't fit my scheme. And so they crucified the Savior. So because they were looking for the second coming with preconceived notions, they missed the first coming altogether. And we do the same thing, because we tend to go find Jesus when we're in trouble, including initially. And so we're looking for the second coming Jesus who will come and rescue us, not realizing that what we're really supposed to be doing is approaching the first coming Jesus who wants a purchase of our sins. So we need to be looking for a master, and we're looking for a savior. And that shapes everything right down the wrong road, which is why we have the church today in the condition that it's in. Alrighty, want to move on? I mean, I don't mind this, but... Yeah, we are studying the book of Samuel, and... I'm on page 164. All right, so we're talking about David and his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite and whatever. And the prophet has confronted him and told him that, you know, God knows what he's done, and he's admitted it and freely, and he's asking God to forgive him. David's responding in a way that God appreciates, but God says the consequences are still the consequences. And one of those consequences is that because you have done this, the sword will not depart from your house. And we've already seen several scenarios where some of his children have been killed because of sin. Amnon has raped David's, Absalom's sister, David's daughter, and Tamar, I think is her name is. And Absalom has killed Amnon. Then Absalom has... risen up and taken over David's throne and raped his concubines and is now trying to hunt him down and kill him. And so David's reaping the whirlwind from his deeds. Now remember, we talk about how God loves David and how David's response is so appreciated by God at a very high level. But none of that prevents God from just beating the living snot out of him over what he has done. Not so much out of anger or bitterness. God has forgiven him and he loves him. But there are consequences to our behavior. And one of the things we suffer with in our world today is we want people not only to forgive us, but take away the consequences. You know, we want people to use their money or their power or whatever to buy us out of the consequences. That's neither healthy nor is it godly. It's not what God wants. There is a gravity. There's a gravitational law about the way we behave and act, that what you sow, you reap. And so we should not be surprised when we suffer the consequences of our behaviors. And God is gracious, and sometimes he ameliorates against that. But Only for his purposes and his reasons. All right, 1 Samuel 17:24. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed over the Jordan, and he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom set Amasa over the army in place of Joab, Now remember that when David first fled from Absalom, David's best counselor, who was Ahithophel, had abandoned David and gone to Absalom and had given him some really good advice, and David was concerned about Absalom's counsel. He sent his friend Hushai the Archite back to pretend that he was with Absalom and to thwart the counsel of Ahithophel. Ahithophel's next counsel was for Absalom to take the men they had and quickly pursue David while he was on the run, kill him and whatever. And that would have been the right thing to do, but Hushai was able to persuade David that that would not have been a good thing to do, because David would be fighting like a wounded tiger, and if Absalom had a quick defeat, the people would abandon him. So that sounded good to Absalom, and he took that advice, which was in David's best interest. And David, Hushai had encouraged him to wait till he gathered all of Israel, so he would have a massive force of people to go against David then, and that seemed good. So Absalom did that, and that saved David. Then David, he came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed over the Jordan, and all the men of the people with him, and Absalom set Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Now Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Ithra the Israelite, who went into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, his sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. Now, remember the map that we were using some time ago? Here, remember this map? If you think of the Jordan River as a kind of a dividing line, everything to the east of the Jordan was occupied by three tribes. They were Manasseh, Reuben, and Gad. Gad and Reuben. These were lands that were taken away from the Amorite kings Og and Sihon, and that had one time belonged to Moab and Amnon. That was east of the Jordan. And when David was fleeing to get away from Absalom, what he was trying to do was to cross over the Jordan. And that's what he did. So they are now in Gilead, which is the sort of central part of this area. And now Absalom has crossed over to come after him. They are at a place called Mahanaim, which was a famous place. It means the place of two camps or two armies, because it was where Jacob met Esau on his way back. It was where he thought Esau was going to kill him and didn't. So that's where they are. Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. Now when David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, the son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the sons of Ammon, Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds and basins and pottery and wheat and barley and flour and parched grain and beans and lentils and parched seeds and honey and curds and sheep and cheese of the herd for David and for the people who were with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. So these people come from all over, and they're really from various groups. Some of them are not even native Jews, but they are supporters of David. They have followers of David and followers of Israel at some level, either as allies or some of them have actually become Jews or whatever. And they bring David a ton of supplies that he would need. I mean, think about this. He's, you know, let's say you had to escape all of a sudden and you hopped in your car and you drove all the way out to the desert somewhere in Montana. Well, when you get out there, then you realize, you know, I didn't pack anything. I mean, I was just trying to get out of town, and I didn't pack anything, and we need food, and we need clothing, and we need, you know, pup tents. I mean, we need all kinds of stuff. You know, when these people go on the run from the government, like these two kids did recently, you know, they never think about what it takes to support all of that, and they eventually just break down because they just can't function. So then they don't take them with money and whatever. And so these people came out of the woodwork to provide for David and his people out here in the wilderness. Absalom and his people are bringing all their stuff with them. They had a chance to organize. So 2 Samuel 18:1, then David numbered the people who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands, commanders of hundreds, and David sent people out, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, which is Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai, the Gittite. Remember, we talked about Ittai last time. He's actually a Philistine who had aligned himself with David for many years. And when David was fleeing, he came and to join himself to David. And David said, this isn't your war. You know, you don't need to be getting yourself into this. You know, you're a Philistine. And he said, yep, it's my war. I'm going with you. So he made him a general over a third of his army. The king said to the people, I myself will surely go out with you. But the people said, you should not go out, for if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us, therefore now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city. David wants to be in the battle, and he didn't want other people to do this fighting for him. But they said, you're too valuable. I mean, if, you know, they'll put everything they have to come and get you, and, you know, that's, they don't care about us. And if half of us get killed, it doesn't end the war. But if you get taken, it's over. And then we're all in trouble. So we need you to stay back here and do the supply line thing. So then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by the hundreds and thousands. The king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Then the people went out in the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David. And the slaughter that day was great, 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. So I think we covered the first part. One of the things that the people, David wanted to go out, but his generals didn't want him to go out for the reason they stated, but also because they knew that he would show grace to Absalom. And they knew that, you know, it would never end as long as Absalom was around. And they knew that David would not let them execute Absalom. Now, remember our story, Absalom's already been given grace twice. First, after he killed Amnon, he fled to Geshur, his grandfather's house in another country. And then he petitioned to be able to come home and be acceptable to David. And so Joab worked that out, the little lady who came and had the story, whatever. And then what happened is Absalom was confined to his own estates, told not to leave there. And after a while, he got upset with that. Remember, he set Joab's fields on fire, whatever. And finally, David gave him grace and let him return to court. And then he set about trying to steal David's throne from him by telling everybody who came to town, if I were king, I would have heard your complaint and I would have ruled in your favor. And he's bent. And the generals know this. They're going to have to fight this war again if they don't deal with Absalom. They know David won't let them do that. So one of the reasons they get him to hold back is so he won't be there to prevent what they need to do. So he warns them he does not want Absalom killed. All David's men heard this order from David to the generals. David's troops win the battle, etc., etc., and many people fleeing through the treacherous forest. They're backed up to a forest. It's a thick, tangled, fairly virgin forest, and a lot of briars and brambles and whatever. And in the process of fleeing, many of them died in the forest, just from the treachery of the forest, the big pits that were covered and whatever. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him kept going. Now remember, we talked about Absalom and his windblown hair and how he had this big fetish with his hair, and he looked like, not Yanni, but that other big muscular guy who was in romance novels. I forget his name. Huh? You know, so usually you saw him, this guy on the book stands, and he's got, you know, no shirt on, and he's rippled like crazy. And he's like oiled up and whatever, and he's got this long hair.
Yeah.
Well, him. So Absalom was like that. He just
sounded like he turned you on, Wayne.
Huh? So he
Fabia,
that's it.
Yeah.
That's the guy.
Okay, who remembers?
I'm ashamed that I remember.
No, I remember his face.
So
I remember his ass.
So anyway, he was fleeing in all of this, and his hair was flopping, and he was on his mule. Now, the fact that he was on his mule means he wasn't there to do battle personally. Remember, we talked about the fact that kings on mules come in peace, but kings on horses come in war. We talked about this before. So he wasn't there to participate in the war. He was there to observe it from the heights. And when he encountered David's soldiers, he fled, and we went through the forest. His hair gets all tangled up in the trees, and he's hanging in the forest from his hair, and he can't do anything with it. He doesn't even have a sword that he can reach up there to cut it with. So his pride has tripped him up in the forest. When a certain man saw it, that's Absalom hanging from a tree, he told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Then Joab said to the man who told him, "Now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." And the man said to Joab, "Even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put my hand out against the king's son, for in our hearing the king charged you, Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Protect me, for me, the young man Absalom. Otherwise, if I dwelt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing that's hidden from the king finds out everything, then you yourself would have stood aloof. You would have stood back and let me take whatever the lick was. So don't tell me about you were going to give me 10 pieces of silver and a belt." Said, I wouldn't kill the king's son. Then Joab said, "Well, I'm going to not waste time here with you. I don't suffer fools. I'm moving on to deal with this." So he took 3 spears in his hand and he thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. That ought to do it. 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. So his direct toadies all got involved and hack around Absalom and whatever, gained favor with Joab. So that is the end of Absalom, but not the end of the problem. Then Joab blew the trumpet. The people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. They took Absalom, and they cast him in a deep pit in the forest, and erected over him a huge great heap of stones. And all of Israel fled, each to his tent. And Joab saw no reason to continue the battle. Once Absalom was gone, they basically cut off the head of the snake. They found one of those treacherous pits that I was talking about, 3 minutes, and just filled it up with stones over top of him. But an indecent burial, as it were. Yeah.
Did you say, what kind of relationship did Joab have?
He's the nephew of David.
Okay, and what was it that they did together?
Oh, what Joab has on David is that when he needed Uriah the Hittite killed, he sent a message to Joab to put Hittai up in the front of the line where he could be killed. Joab has been David's faithful general from the very beginning, and he is a good general. But he and his brothers, Amasai and Abishai, are bloodthirsty people, the sons of Zeruiah. They are, you know, it's like if you're not careful to manage the generals in your country, they will always keep you in war because that's what they know. If you're a hammer, everything's a nail. And they need war because that's what they do. You remember that Kennedy warned in his State of the Union thing about the great military industrial complex that we were building and how that would set us in a position where we would have to go to war because we were building all this stuff, we had to use it. And there are many who thought that his execution was because of that. He had actually put together a bill to go before the Congress which would have stripped the Joint Chief of Staff and the Chiefs of Staff and the military generals and all of that of much of their power once he was...
Huh? Wasn't that Eisenhower?
No. Eisenhower also warned the people against that. But Kennedy put this bill together, and as soon as Johnson came in, he killed the bill. Eisenhower warned the people against the great military industrial contract also. But Kennedy, he saw the wisdom of this. So, at any rate, in the, if you look at the conspiracy theories, that's, you know, who is his name? At any rate, they proposed five theories of how Kennedy was killed. You know, the lone gunman, the Cuban thing, the military, whatever, the mafia, and basically said, well, they're probably all true, you know, whatever. The movie's called JFK. It's a pretty interesting movie. Tommy Lee Jones plays a guy that they put on trial for being a conspirator and all this. So the guy who dances
Kevin
with...
Costner.
Huh?
Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
He played the attorney.
Yeah. All righty. So back to where we are here. Absalom in his lifetime had taken up for himself a pillar which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to preserve my name, I see. So he named the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. When then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies. Now Ahimaaz, remember, is the son of the chief priest. Remember, Zadok is back in Jerusalem trying to hold together Zadok is with, yeah, Zadok's back in Jerusalem. David told him to take the Ark of the Covenant back. And Ahimaaz, his son, has been the go-between back and forth between Hushai and David to bring information back and forth. So Ahimaaz is out here in the battle, and he says, let me run tell David this great news that Absalom is dead. Joab said to him, you are not the man to carry the news this day, but you shall carry the news another day. However, you shall carry no news today because the king's son is dead. Joab knows very well that David is not going to be pleased with whoever brings him this news. Joab knows that Ahimaaz is a really good kid, and he doesn't want him in trouble over this issue. Joab said to this Cushite he found, one of those soldiers, he can waste a Cushite here, not, you know. So he says, go tell the king what you've seen. So the Cushite bowed to Joab and ran. Now Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said once more to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, why would you run, my son, since you have no reward for going? But whatever happens, he said, I will run. So he said, then run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and passed up the Cushite, who was in a big hurry to get to David. Now David was sitting between two gates, and a watchman went up on the roof of the gate by the wall, raised his eyes and looked. Behold, a man running by himself. And the watchman called and told the king. And the king said, if he is by himself, there is good news in his mouth. Now, what happens is he is seeing this one man come, and he is expecting an euangelion. An euangelion is a Greek word, which means the news. It means either the news of a great victory or the news of the birth of a king's son. That's what an euangelion is. The most famous euangelion is the runner from Marathon who took the battle of informational battle of Thermopylae and took it back to Athens. It was Athens. Anyway, so, you know, the marathon is 25 some miles because that was the distance between Thermopylae and whatever. And the marathon runner came and told them that the Greeks had won against the Persians. The word euangelion is translated good news, and later it became translated gospel. So when we use the word gospel in Greek, it's the word euangelion. Euangelion is spelled euangelion. And if you realize that if you convert that into a Latin script, it's evangelion.
Spell that again.
Euangelion, euangelion. Just think of evangelism, but stick a U where the V is. If there's good news, the single runner is coming. If it's bad news, the troops are fleeing back. David is told that there's this one runner coming. So the watchman told David, the king said, if he's by himself, there's good news in his mouth. And he came nearer and nearer, and the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, behold, another man running by himself. And the king says, this one is also bringing good news. And the watchman said, I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, I'm Oz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he's a good man. He's coming with good news. Now, Ahimaaz called and said to the king, all is well, and he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. He's probably trying to catch his breath as well. He said, blessed is the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king. And the king said, is it well with the young man Absalom? And Ahimaaz, who's suddenly getting insight, said, when Joab sent the king's servant and your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was. Well, that's a fib. And the king said, well, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. And behold, the Cushite arrived. And the Cushite said, let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered and said, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. And the king was deeply moved and went to his chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said, as he walked, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. The Cushite is not at all aware politically of what's going on here. He's an Ethiopian. He's been in Israel for who knows how long. He's been in Joab's army for who knows how long. But his, culturally speaking, he's not a Jew. David goes immediately into deep mourning and grief, and he wishes that he himself had died, that Absalom had lived. Too bad David had not received him and allowed him into his heart sooner. None of this would have happened in all likelihood. David is showing a propensity for failing to address his son's issues until they become critical. Then it was told Joab, behold, the king was weeping, and he mourns for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people, for the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son. So people went by stealth into the city that day as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. And the king covered his face and cried with a loud voice, oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. So the battle, instead of being a victory, turned into a great mourning, and the people all felt bad, like they had done something wrong. Joab came to the house of the king, and he said, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life, and the lives of your sons and daughters, and the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you, and by hating those who love you. You're upset with your troops for killing your son, instead of being happy with it, that they have saved you and all of your family from death. For you have shown that the princes and the servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. So the king arose and sat in the gate, and all the people, and they told all the people, saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate. Then all the people came before the king. He said, if you don't go out and deal with this issue, the warriors will all slink off home. And when they get home, they're going to say, you know, I put my life on the line to save him and all this kind of stuff. And when we got victory, all he could think about was the fact that his rich brat, who deserved all of that, was dead, and he was not at all thankful or whatever. And Joab said, and rightly so, if you do this, if you don't fix this, that spirit will get into the people, and your next problem will be worse than the one you have now. So Joab is, of course, right about this. So when David recognizes the truth of it, he forces himself to go out and sit in the gate and to let the people parade before him in victory and to bless them and to thank them and whatever. And that saves the day. He has to force that. Some semblance of victory was restored to the people. Now Israel, that would be Absalom's group, Absalom's people, had fled each to his tent. And all the people were quarreling through all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hands of the Philistines. But now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back? So there's now a brouhaha in Israel about what to do next. Absalom's dead. They've aligned themselves with Absalom. What should they do? Should they invite David back as their king? Should they put somebody else among them up as king? Whatever. In other words, should we have a prolonged civil war here? Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring back the king to his house, since the word of Israel has come to the king, even to his house? You are my brothers, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then would you be the last to bring me back?" So there's a there's a split among the tribes of Judah about returning to David or setting somebody else up. This is inside of the tribe of Judah. "And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me. And more also, if you will not be my commander of the army for me continually in place of Joab." Amasa was Absalom's general. He was also David's kin. He had sided with Absalom. And Amasa, like Abner before him, had in his hand the army, that had risen up for Absalom against David. And he's told Amasa, we're kin. And if you come back to me and return to me, I will make you general of the army instead of Joab. Because he's not happy with Joab. Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man. So they sent word to David, saying, "Return, you and all your servants." And the king then returned and came as far as the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal in order to meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. So the victory over Absalom wasn't enough to end the civil war. But what David did next would decide that. And so David, rather than either A, continuing to flee, allowing somebody else to rise up over Absalom's place, or attacking, you know, the people back in Jerusalem, causing all manner of problems, including trashing the city of Jerusalem, causing himself to have a warfare with even his own tribesmen, he reaches out and asks them to bring him back and whatever, and offers them some goodies for that. And they accept him. So Amasa, who's David's cousin, but Absalom's former general, is offered the position of army of Israel. It was a brilliant move that was popular with the people, but bitter for Joab to swallow. David had enough of Joab's bloodlust that he had demonstrated by killing Absalom and Abner before him, if you remember. Both of these acts were personal vendettas that were not good for the establishment of David's kingdom. Judah reconciled with David and met him at Gilgal to bring him back over the Jordan and to Jerusalem. David's wisdom healed Israel from yet another civil war. Joab's wickedness is not yet finished. We will see his actions yet again twice. Because Joab holds the knowledge of David's sin, Uriah the Hittite in hand, David is not able to do more than scold him. Our sins capture us in ways that are ongoing. David can't deal with Joab. Joab's got the pictures. Joab's got the evidence. He's afraid to deal with that. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Y'all remember Shimei? Shimei was the guy who was throwing stones at him and spitting at him and throwing dust on him and all his people and saying, "Look, you're a murderer," he's of the house of Saul. "You're a murderer and you killed the house of Saul and you killed his descendants and whatever, and now you're being punished, you pig," you know, remember that? And remember Joab said, "Let me go up there and take his head away from him." And David said, "No, you know, let him curse me, because if he's right, I probably deserve it. And if he's wrong, God will feel bad for me that I'm being falsely accused." Of course, he thinks he's wrong, because David actually killed no one of Saul's family. So now Shimei sees which way the wind's blown, and he's now groveling. I think I named this chapter Grief, Groveling, and Godly Grandfather. Yeah. So there's a bunch of people who are groveling now. They're trying to make their peace. So he hurries down to meet King David. and there are 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they rushed to the Jordan before the king. And then they kept crossing to the ford to bring over the king's household and do what was good in his sight. So they rush down there to serve the king and carry his luggage and everything across and bring his people across safely. These are all the sons and men of Benjamin, Benjamin being the tribe Saul was in. And they're trying to reposition themselves in a good position with David. Now, Ziba was in a good position with David because, remember, he had showed up with a lot of... He was the first guy to show up with a lot of supplies and stuff. Ziba, you remember, was the man that David appointed to be the overseer of all of the property of Saul on behalf of Mephibosheth, the crippled son of Saul, of Jonathan, whom David had found. There was a point after David's reign got Saul settled in that for Jonathan's sake he wanted to bless the house of Saul. And he heard that one of the sons of Saul, Mephibosheth, still lived. And Mephibosheth had been taken up by his nurse when Saul was killed and to rush to safety, and she dropped him and it crippled him. He wasn't able to, I don't know how crippled he was, but he wasn't able to walk around, get around. So when David was looking for somebody to bless, then he restored to all the property of Saul, all his wealth, to Mephibosheth. And he took Ziba, Saul's steward, and said, "You will, and your sons will manage all of this for Mephibosheth." When David fled, Ziba showed up with a whole bunch of supplies. And David said, "Well, where's Mephibosheth?" And Ziba said, "Well, he's not backing you," which was a lie. Or probably was a lie. Anyway, so they all come rushing down, Ziba and Shimei, other Benjamites, to help David get across. Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what the servant did wrong the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so the king should take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, first of all, the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, Should not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And David said to him, What do I have to do with you, sons of Zeruiah? You're always going to guns. Every time somebody comes in, you want to cut their heads off. This is the brother to Joab, right? That you should this day be an adversary to me. Why are you guys always putting me in a position of having to kill somebody and working against the political good of reestablishing myself? Is the whole world to you about battles? Is the whole world, is all of life to you about fighting battles because you're soldiers? Do you have any room in your heart for peace at all? Or you just want to keep provoking battles so that you do your thing? Should any man be put to death today in Israel? For I do not know that I am king over Israel. Do I not know that I'm the king over Israel today? Has God not restored me to the throne? So why would we want this to be a day when we're putting people to death? The king said to Shimei, You shall not die. And then the king swore to him. Grace is a gear that the sons of Zeruiah do not possess. This reminds me very much of the difference between the Allied approach after World War I and the Allied approach after World War II concerning the Axis. After World War I, you remember, and Britain was taking the lead in this, but the Allies put a huge penalty and a thumb over Germany and the other Axis countries. And in Germany in particular, they forbid them to mount an army, they forbid them to build weapons of war, they forbid them all kinds of things so that they wouldn't rise up again. And their policies were heavy and punitive. It would be like when the Philistines had taken over during the time of Samson, and they forbid the Jews to be able to make anything with iron. They had to come to the Philistine forges to get their plows sharpened because the Philistines didn't want them to be able to make weapons. Well, that's what happened after World War I. And it created an atmosphere where the common, ordinary German people felt abused and put upon for something that was not their fault. So some 30 years later, you have all these secret societies built into the German structure because people are trying to, behind the scenes, away from the watchdogs, are trying to restore German national heritage. And then you have people who are out in the political arena who are mouthing off about all of this, and you have some people who are on the side of the Kaiser and all the, actually it's not the Kaiser at this point, but the German heads of state who are cooperating with the Allies and saying, you know, they're just selling us down the river. Of course, one of those was a disenchanted paper hanger, wallpaper hanger named Hitler.
That was a Freudian slip.
Adolf Hitler. Oh, he would have hated that. But at any rate, yeah, I didn't really mean anybody. But at any rate, it was so Hitler. And, you know, Hitler had been arrested for being a dissident. And while he was in prison, he wrote Mein Kampf. People write all kinds of things while they're in prison, you know. Including, you know, Marx and Lenin and Paul the Apostle. They all find a good time to write. Mandela. So what happened is that his feelings about people standing up against the Allies and restoring German national culture and pride struck a very strong chord in people who, many of them, were belonging to very secret societies just sort of keep the heritage of their culture going, whatever. And so people who ordinarily would not have listened to somebody like Hitler lined up behind him because he was the only one speaking for them to be able to get out from under the thumb of all of this. Stories are told about German car factories that would be visited by the Allied inspectors who would come, who went all over the country trying to make sure that they were keeping the treaty. And as soon as the inspectors were gone, they'd roll the cars out and then roll the tanks in, you know, from where they had them hidden so they could keep building them. So one day Hitler shows up with a huge military in place, and nobody knows where it comes from. Instead of building an army, he goes out and builds youth groups and puts them all into this whole military format. And from the youth, he raises all them up and indoctrinates them and trains them so that when he's ready, they just step right into uniform and they're thinking like he is, whatever. And he, you know, he paints it, a lot of it, as just people responding to the lost German culture. So a lot of people are sending their kids along to these youth groups thinking, well, that's good for them, not realizing, you know, that Hitler's intent is to turn these people into savages, to turn them into murderers and whatever. When that all begins to emerge, many of the German people are horrified, but now it's too late. He's gotten too far down the road. He's overthrown the chancellor, at least, if not physically yet, in terms of power and authority. When the British see that, Churchill is screaming, you know, look what they're doing. And of course, Chamberlain, who is representing the basic feelings of the people, that they don't want war at any cost, because the British paid horrible prices in human loss in World War I, and largely because they went into World War I with these feudal notions that the educated people from Oxford and Cambridge ought to be the generals, and all of the common people ought to be the stub soldiers, and the educated people from Oxford and Cambridge were, some of them, competent, many of them, if not most of them, were not. And they were basically reading about these great battles of the past and the glory of marching into the valley, of the, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they were stupid concerning the things of war. And they led the British into just a slaughter. And it took most of the war until they got the professional soldier on top and the academics out of the way, the upper class, the nobility. There were people who said, well, you know, we need a general, and this guy over here is lord of this or that. You know, remember Downton Abbey, Grantham wanted to be a general again, or a high officer again, and they were having none of that in the World War II. So Britain had paid horrible, horrible prices, and the people had taken 20 some odd years to get over the last war, and this is 10 years later, and now all of a sudden Hitler's threatening and the people don't want war, and so Chamberlain's representing the hearts of the people, and Winston Churchill is screaming, look out, don't you see what they're doing? Look out, look out. And of course, Churchill was right, but too late. So, I think where I am is verse 2 Samuel 19:24. Any comments or anything so far, y'all? Just in World War I, grace was not a gear that the Allies possess, and they made the mistake of being punitive and heavily punitive and punitive over a long haul against the Axis countries, which caused them to feel, you know, that there was no way to find their way back. So it created enemies. After World War II, what happened is that they it was a Marshall Plan or whatever it was called. They went in and helped the Axis countries, Japan and Germany in particular, to rise up out of the ashes. They went in and funded their reestablishment. There's this guy who has this whole thing about quality, total quality. I forget his name right now, but he was an American who went to Japan, and he taught the Japanese how to build quality stuff. Because if y'all remember, after the war, things were called, people would say, Japanese junk, because everything you saw made in Japan was flimsy and whatever, and there'd be little tags on it, and it'd be like the Swiss or the little umbrellas that go in, you know, whatever. It was true trash, and if kids got stuff and it said Japan on it, it'd be broken in no time. And this guy, I forget his name, he goes to Total Quality Management, TQM.
It was a Six Sigma.
Huh?
It was a Six Sigma thing.
Six. Well, that was, it was the precursor. It was precursor to Six Sigma. TQM, Total Quality Management, came first. So this guy, American, goes into Japan, and he teaches them, make it right once. Huh?
Deming.
Yeah, the Deming Award. Right. Yeah, so he teaches them, make it right once, make it high quality, whatever, make it slower, make it good. Well, what happened is Japanese started putting out superior products, so did the Germans. And then what happened is the Americans didn't take advantage of the wisdom of one of their own people, and we started making junk because we were making it fast, and we were, you know, if you make 100,000 of them and 80,000 of them are good, you know, that's...
Deming wanted to talk to the U.S. companies first, and they wouldn't even take...
Yeah, that's right. So, at any rate, what happened is the Japanese and German industries took over because people bought the good stuff, paid more for it, and bought it. Well, that was the difference in the approach after World War II versus World War I. And David understood the approach of World War II. To forgive your enemies and to support their reestablishment. Now, they hadn't had near as much destruction and everything to deal with, but to show grace and all that sort of thing. And all Joab and his ilk could think of was, you know, now we got them down, let's keep them down, and you know, let's beat them up and kill as many as we find, whatever, reign of terror, that kind of thing. And David said, you know, these guys are not wise at all, and you're costing me a lot. That will come back to haunt Joab eventually.
This was Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, so, and I think after every war, there's always the battle of how do we win the peace? And one side says, let's just stomp them and keep stomping them and keep stomping them. And the other guy goes, you know, let's don't do that. Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he neither cared for his feet nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he'd come home in peace. So he came in to see David, and he was smelly and ugly looking and dirty and whatever, and he claimed that as soon as David had to flee that he quit washing and cleaning and whatever. In other words, he was living in mourning for the loss of the king. It's a pretty showy thing. And it was when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? Why didn't you come and join me when I left town? Your Ziba and his sons, they came and joined me, your stewards. So he answered and said, oh, my lord, the king, my servant deceived me, Ziba. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, then I might ride on it and go with the king, because your servant is lame. For myself, I may ride on it and go with the king, because your servant is lame. Moreover, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like an angel of God. Angel being messenger here. Therefore, do what is good in your sight. For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king. Before my lord the king came, yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king? So he said, Ziba deceived me. I asked him to put me together, the transport to come and go out with you, and he abandoned me in my crippled nature. I couldn't come. He took off and he said, I was nothing before you gave me something. He said, none of the people of Saul had anything until you restored the house of Saul. And I don't really care about all the goods and stuff, but I do want the favor of the king. So the king said to him, why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided. You and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house. So David said, you know, I'm got time to sort through this. So I'm going to split the land. Ziba can have half and you can have half. Because remember, he had given all to Ziba, and now he's only going to give him half. Now, Barzillai, the Gileadite, had come down from Rogalim, and he went on the Jordan with the king to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai, remember, he's the godly grandfather here. Barzillai was a man who had showed up with supplies along with several other people. And he was old. He was in his 80s probably. Now Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old. That's pretty close. And he had sustained the king while he stayed at Maanaim, for he was a very great man. So when David was camped out in the wilderness, Barzillai had pulled together the resources for the king to survive. The king said to Barzillai, you cross over me and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me. Now it's time for me to take care of you. So you come on back to Jerusalem and I'll fix you up with a place to live and you'll eat at my table and I will take care of you richly. Barzillai said to the king, you know what, I'm old. I mean, how long have I yet to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? You know, the transition alone would be irritating. You know, I mean, I want to die in my own bed. I want to be at my own home. Thank you for all that, but I don't need that. He said, I'm now 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good and bad? I can barely see. I can barely hear, barely taste, and forgot what a woman feels like. So can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? No, I can't. Or can I hear any more of the voice of singing men and women? I can't hear. What then should your servant be but an added burden to my lord the king? I would just be some pensioner you have to take care of down there. Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. However, here is your servant Chimham, that would be his son. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what is good in your sight. And the king answered and said, Chimham shall cross over with me and I will do for him what is good in your sight. In your sight, and whatever you require of me, I will do for you. So I will give to Chimham all that I would have given to you. The people crossed over the Jordan and the king crossed too. The king kissed Barzillai and blessed him. And he returned to his place. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. All the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel, accompanied the king. Comments here before we move on to something else? Oh, is it time? Okay. Well, we'll stop then. Any comments before we stop?